The rise of infectious diseases that resist treatment with antibiotics is never more clear than in war zones. It's a problem that's been highlighted by a new report on Palestine. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism interviewed doctors in Gaza and the West Bank who say they're battling an epidemic of antibiotic-resistant superbugs. It found that Gaza is a particularly fertile breeding ground for superbugs because its health system has suffered under the Israeli blockade and antibiotics are in short supply. But it's not just overseas. Antibiotic-resistant infections are spreading in Australia too, with concerns in Victoria about an antibiotic-resistant ulcer disease leading to the CSIRO investigating possible causes. Professor Peter Collignon is an infectious diseases expert at the School of Clinical Medicine at the Australian National University in Canberra. Welcome back to Breakfast, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we hear a lot, of course, these days about bugs that have been building up resistance to antibiotics, at least the antibiotics at our disposal. Why is it an even greater problem in conflict zones like parts of Palestine?
Well, antibiotic resistance is around us all the time, but what we do as people is we make it worse by amplifying it and more particularly by spreading it. So you can imagine if you're in a war zone, lots of things go wrong. First of all, you can't get the right antibiotic often, and you may give one that's broader spectrum, or you can't do the microbiological test, so you can't see what you're supposed to be treating, therefore using broader spectrum ones. But probably what's more important is the spread of infection. You can imagine if you cram a whole lot of people into a hospital with open wounds and poor, you know, supply of gloves and even the space to separate them. One person has a bug, it will easily go to the other person. The other major issue, though, for the population is the water supply. Often that goes wrong. The sewage doesn't work properly, so you spread bugs from people to people via water or contaminated food. And that is very common in the developing world in general. And often if you have a war, you obviously decrease your economic status and you go more to that lower, you know, economic status. We did a study that we had published last year where we looked around the world. Why is there so much higher resistance in China, Vietnam compared to Scandinavia or Australia, which is relatively low levels of resistance from an international scale? And we always assume it's the amount of antibiotics you use. You know, you're using too much, decrease it. And that is a factor. You know, we've done other research as well. But what we found when we compared countries, the biggest factor that explained why one country had a higher resistance versus others was infrastructure, meaning water supply, sewage. And the other big factor, or the only other factor that came out, was in fact when we looked at the corruption levels of countries. The higher your corruption levels, the higher you have resistance. And that's taking into account the GDP and a whole lot of economic factors as well. And I think what that means is if you have more corruption, you follow rules less often. So substandard things get done. People don't check the types of antibiotics, you know, your counterfeit ones. People dump stuff into waterways, and that's, you know, without checking. You might have rules, but nobody follows them. So for a whole lots of reasons, it means the population is more exposed to what we call contagion. So it's more likely that bugs will spread from person to person much more widely, or from the animal sector to people as well, because they're in water and food.
So when we're talking about Palestine, for example, then, and the problems there, if you're talking about this issue around water and sewage infrastructure, and those problems there are very, very well known, what are the implications for not just Palestine, but for neighbouring countries if we're talking about water and sewage?
Well, first of all, it's what water comes into them from where, and even if it is contaminated, have they ability to, you know, even chlorinate it properly so that you decrease the bug levels? But it's got a lot of other implications, because where does their water go? You know, who does it travel to? And this is an issue globally.
So is this an issue for Israel then? I'm just wondering, given that they're instituting this blockade, is it at their own detriment ultimately?
Well, it is, and Israel can have much higher levels of antibiotic resistance as well. Now, whether that's coming because it's coming across from the Gaza to them, I can't answer that. But what I do know is if you have an area with high levels of antibiotic resistance, be it India, be it China, be it Gaza, that just doesn't affect the people in that area. People travel with these bugs. We see Australian tourists going overseas, bringing them back, and they persist with these bugs for 6 months or more. So that if it may live mostly in their gut harmlessly, but if you're unlucky enough to get appendicitis or gallbladder problem, well, guess what? You've got a superbug causing a serious infection that's difficult to treat that you picked up somewhere else. And with the globalization of food and things like that, we spread these bugs all around the world. And so it's in our interest to, in fact, decrease war zones and increase the, you know, how people are living everywhere, because it comes back and bites us. And the closer you are to those areas, the more it bites you.
So clearly aid workers would be a real risk.
Well, aid workers would, because they're going into areas that have generally got poorer water supplies, poorer sewage. They're in contact with people with open wounds, so they can pick it up more. So I can't actually answer that with any data I'm aware of, but I'd be very surprised if aid workers did not have a higher level of carriage of antibiotic-resistant superbugs.
Peter, what's the human cost of these superbugs in war zones and the developing countries? I mean, how much of a toll do they take on populations there?
Well, they take a big toll. You can imagine in the 1920s, before we had antibiotics, if you had a golden staph infection in your blood, there was an 80% chance you were dead within 30 days. Now, the effect of superbugs is that the antibiotics we've had or got don't work as well or may not work at all. And we know, again, the data is mainly from places like Europe or developing countries, because they're the only ones that can collect it. But with the E. coli germ, which all of us carry and is very common cause of urinary tract infections and bloodstream infections. If you have a bug that's resistant to one of the better antibiotics called triazone, you've got twice the chance of dying if you get that in your blood. And if you survive, you stay in hospital on average an extra 5 days. So there's no doubt if you pick up a MRSA superbug, you know, the staph one, or you pick up an E. coli and it's a superbug, even if antibiotics work, you will have a worse outcome. But what's happening more and more, we have bugs that are untreatable. Bugs called Acinetobacter that, spread from person to person, but you get that and you're in an ICU unit or you've got a severe infection, well, basically, it just keeps on multiplying. Unless your own body's immune system, like the 1920s, can get on top of it, you will just get a progressive disease and a larger proportion of those people will die.
It's frightening stuff. Peter, you talked about and you've made a very strong point about the need for better water and sewage infrastructure to tackle this issue. But obviously, there's a lot of work underway as well around developing better antibiotics to tackle these bugs. Is that the ultimate solution here?
No, I don't think it's the ultimate solution. I do think we need new drugs. But the problem is bugs spread. And so in hospitals, in the wider community globally, we need to stop that spread. And perversely, just getting a new expensive antibiotic may not solve the problem at all, because everybody thinks, oh, problem's over, we won't worry about the basic stuff. If you want to stop superbugs, it's basic stuff you have to do. You have to not use antibiotics when you don't need them. You need to use them, you know, narrow spectrum ones. And I might say Australia uses in people twice as many antibiotics as they should per head. And in the agricultural section worldwide, we use probably 10 times more than we have, because
there's been a lot of focus on that, though. Is there science that that's turning around?
Yes, there is science that it's turning around. In the US, for instance, they've dropped their antibiotic consumption by 30%. I've been involved in the World Health Organization putting out guidelines, and places like McDonald's, for instance, are starting to make that part of their policy if you want to sell to them. So there are effects. We are seeing benefits. And we can also see, if we look at the available science, that if you do this, you can actually decrease the resistance level that people carry, and also, in fact, then, how much death and suffering you have. So you can have an effect. But we need to go further. If we just concentrate on drugs, we will miss the big picture, which is the spread. Because if you look in our own hospitals, people who have VRE or MRSA, they didn't just spontaneously mutate those. They've got them from somebody else. So in hospitals, it's everything from good hand hygiene to better infection control, better cleaning of the environment so you don't pick this up. But more broadly, the biggest way that superbugs are spread between people is through contamination. contaminated water and then indirectly through contaminated food. And it's in our self-interest to make sure that everywhere around the world, be it Gaza, be it Vietnam, be it China, that the water is improved, that governance and corruption are improved, that we don't have wars which make these things all fall down and people, you know, living in poverty, etc. We need to fix all those things, better housing, if we really want to make a dent on superbugs and stop what is now the inevitable rise globally and it coming back home to roost here.
Pete, I do need to come to bring this conversation to closer to home, and that, of course, is the issue around Victoria right now. Scientists are still scratching their heads over the huge increase we've seen in cases of the Bruelli ulcer, which is this awful flesh-eating disease. In 2018, the state had 336 cases, and that compared with just 89 cases 4 years earlier. How is it that in an advanced country like ours, the best minds are still baffled by this disease?
Well, I think some good minds have been working on it, particularly in Victoria. But this is a bug that, if you like, you could regard as a superbug because it's difficult to treat, but it's naturally resistant. And it's a bug that's in the environment. It's a bug called Mycobacterium ulcerans, so it's distantly related to the tuberculosis germ. It's been around since at least the 1930s, presumably, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years, because it used to be called the Barnsdale ulcer. It was the original place it was found in Victoria and Australia. But there's more and more of them. Probably a real increase. We have better tests now, something called a PCR, where we can look for the molecular footprint of it, which means you can make the diagnosis quicker. Some do get better by themselves, but I think there is a true increase. Now, why that is, we don't know. It's in the environment. It's associated with animals like possums, at least in their feces. Mosquitoes may have a role. Maybe there's more of it because, you know, there's more moisture or it's warmer and so it's growing.
It's normally a tropical disease, isn't it?
It is normally a tropical disease, and Bruelli, I think, is a place in Africa, in Uganda, where it you know, there's much more cases. So it's patchy where it is. But, for instance, why is it so common around Melbourne, which isn't regarded as usually a really hot tropical place, compared to Sydney or Brisbane, for instance? So we don't have answers to all those. It's a mixture of what animals might be harbouring it in low numbers, where is it multiplying, either in the environment, in the gut, are there different mosquitoes or insects that are involved with this that are more locally present rather than others. But at the end of the day, what appears to happen, we get this infection in us because we either get a puncture in our skin or something punches our skin, maybe an insect, and then it grows and multiplies. Presumably a lot of people it just dies because of their own immune system, but in some people it becomes a little lump and then it becomes an ulcer because the skin breaks down and you have this ongoing ulcer that can get deeper and deeper and last untreated for years.
Yeah, it's not certainly not one you want. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Professor Peter Collignon, he's an infectious diseases expert at the School of Clinical Medicine at the Australian National University.